Why does your dog get a Lyme vaccine, but you can't?
Individuals who, in desperation, have gone to veterinarians and convinced the veterinarian to inject them with the canine vaccine.
Being Sick in America, a look at illness and society. I'm Susan Barnett, and this is 51%, the Women's Perspective. Spring is here, and if you live in the Northeast and Midwest, it means the ticks are back, and so is the threat of Lyme disease. According to the Center for Disease Control, Lyme disease is the most common vector-borne disease reported in the U.S., but most cases are from just 13 states. Modern science has given us a vaccine to protect against Lyme disease, but we don't use it. Reporter Kurt Nickisch explains.
11-year-old Ned Kelly is in for his annual physical at a clinic in Boston's Jamaica Plain neighborhood. As part of his checkup, he's getting a booster shot to protect him against Lyme disease. Ned doesn't like needles, but he holds still while Dr. Joel K. squeezes the pink serum under his skin.
You're a good boy. A little pinch. We'll be home free. All right, good job. Done. All right, handsome.
Ned is lucky because he's one of the select few who can get the vaccine that gives him immunity against Lyme disease. Ned is lucky because he's a dog. We're at the MSPCA Angel Animal Medical Center, where dogs are regularly vaccinated against Lyme. Ned, the dog's owner, Joe Turchin, lives in Falmouth. Ticks are bad there, and Lyme is prevalent. He's glad he can protect his dog, but he wishes there were a human vaccine, too.
You know, if there were a vaccine, our doctors would be suggesting it to us, certainly for those of us who live on the Cape and the islands, because it's a horrendous plague.
That's when I told Turchin that there is a Lyme vaccine for people. It's just that no one makes it anymore.
Why not?
Why not? The answer might depress you.
Lyme disease is the only infection that I know of for which we have a safe and effective vaccine, but it's not available to the public.
To find out why it's not available, I talked to Alan Steer. He's the physician who discovered Lyme disease. Steer was 33 years old back in 1975 when he was sent to the Connecticut town of Lyme to look into a mysterious cluster of kids who'd gotten arthritis.
4 or 5 months into the investigation, we came to suspect that ticks may be involved.
Steer's team had found a previously unknown disease, and ever since, Lyme has been his life's work. After the discovery, he and other scientists first isolated the spiral-shaped bacterium that causes Lyme disease, and then found ways to make people immune to it. Today, Steer's laboratory is at Massachusetts General Hospital. He says finding a biological pathway to vaccinate against Lyme was a major milestone.
Lyme disease was epidemic in certain locations, particularly in the northeastern United States. So here was the possibility of really changing that.
By the mid-1990s, two pharmaceutical companies began trials of candidate vaccines. Gregory Poland is a vaccinologist at the Mayo Clinic. He says the vaccines helped people build up lots of antibodies.
So that when a tick bites you and sucks your blood, it is sucking up the antibodies out of your blood. Those antibodies go into the tick's gut, kill the Lyme organisms that are there. So when that tick then regurgitates into your skin, you don't get Lyme disease.
Poland says as innovative as these vaccines were for killing the Lyme bacterium before it even got into your body, they weren't perfect. You had to get booster shots, so it took a year to become immune. It wasn't approved for children 14 and under. Still, for those 15 and above, it worked pretty well. Human trials conducted by Alan Steer showed that more than 80% of those vaccinated gained immunity. Introduced in 1998, the vaccine sold well at first, but then opponents spoke out, self-described vaccine victims, similar to people today who claim vaccines cause autism. Back then, they said that the Lyme vaccine gave them arthritis. Vaccinologist Gregory Poland.
And this sort of got into popular lore. It spread on the internet. There were a number of East Coast lawyers who started putting together class action lawsuits. There were anti-vaccine advocacy groups.
And there were threats against the scientists who had worked to help protect people. Alan Steer got a security detail. Now, the clinical data did not back up any of this. The trials had not shown such side effects. The FDA and CDC looked into the claims and recommended people continue getting the vaccine. But it was too late. Sales had plummeted. 4 years after offering people immunity against Lyme, SmithKline Beecham stopped making the vaccine. The second vaccine maker, Pasteur Mario Cannat, saw what had happened and never put out its own product. Gregory Poland says since then, Lyme has spread, becoming the most common tick-borne disease in the country.
Now, with the withdrawal of the vaccine, people are doing all kinds of things. I'm personally aware of individuals who, in desperation, have gone to veterinarians and remarkably convinced the veterinarian to inject them with the canine vaccine.
Despite the growing demand to have access to a human vaccine, many drug companies say they're not interested in working on one.
Well, I think there are so many diseases.
Farshad Girahu is an R&D director at Sanofi Pasteur, the vaccines division of the drug giant Sanofi. His company is working instead on a vaccine for dengue fever.
For diseases like Lyme disease, the medical need is smaller. So when we need to put our resources, we obviously have to put where the medical need is greater, and then you can make the vaccine.
With little to no interest from drug companies, some people want government to step in, even state government. At a hearing of the new Massachusetts Lyme Disease Commission, veterinarian Sam Telford suggested the state of Massachusetts license GlaxoSmithKline's FDA-approved vaccine.
We all know that the market has changed. People are fed up. I mean, this is a terrible situation we're in, which means that a vaccine still makes sense.
Telford says the state could make it at the UMass Biologics Laboratory in Jamaica Plain, which has made other vaccines before. GlaxoSmithKline would not say whether it would consider such an option. So for now, there's no sign of any vaccine becoming available. And if there were, Mayo Clinic vaccinologist Gregory Poland says the old opponents are already promising to fight the introduction of any new Lyme vaccine.
So we know scientifically how to develop a vaccine that would protect against all this human misery. And yet, for these sort of societal or cultural reasons, not scientific reasons, that will not be done in the foreseeable future in the U.S.
Alan Steer is a little more hopeful. The man who first connected the mysterious affliction to the ticks of Lyme, Connecticut, back in 1975, has worked on the disease his entire professional life. Losing the human vaccine that he had helped along, he admits, was a major setback.
Multiple things happened. What I'd like to see happen now is that it's possible to move on, even make a better vaccine. I think that's still possible.
Until that day, people are going to have to try to protect themselves. Long pants, insecticides, body inspections. People are going to have to keep living with Lyme. In Boston, I'm Kurt Nickisch.
Coming up, trying to convince doctors you're actually sick and comparing the cancer experience in U.S. and Africa. If you missed part of this show or want to hear it again, visit the 51% archives at WAMC.org. This week's show is number 1245. Two Norwegian researchers published a report in 2011 linking chronic fatigue syndrome with overactive B cells, which play a role in immunity. It's an important break in dealing with an illness that many doctors have been slow in acknowledging. Often, people suffering from chronic fatigue are told their problems are all in their head. Producer Brianna O'Higgins created this narrative of three women battling chronic fatigue.
I remember when I was lying in bed one day listening to the radio, and there was a story about a young man who had died of AIDS. And I just started weeping, and I could not figure it out. Why am I crying about this man that I don't even know? And then suddenly I realized I wasn't crying for him. I was crying for me. He at least died. and got out of it. I pictured that my life would be in this bed forever.
They had no comprehension of how far beyond fatigue this actually was. This was like a little mini death.
My name is Susan Schacht, and I have chronic fatigue syndrome.
My name is Lily Berry, and I was diagnosed with chronic fatigue immune dysfunction syndrome.
My name is Anna, and I was diagnosed with chronic fatigue syndrome.
My name is Judith Lopez, and my diagnosis at this point is chronic fatigue immune dysfunction syndrome.
Do you know how it feels when you go down with the flu, how everything aches, the back, the neck?
Just unbelievable fatigue and tremendous difficulty concentrating.
Extreme exhaustion.
Sleep problems.
Severe joint pains.
Oh, the aches.
Severe headache.
Falling asleep and staying asleep.
Migrating muscle and joint pain.
There's a lot of brain fog, we call it.
I was told invariably that there was no such condition and that I was imagining what was going on.
I had one cardiologist just laugh at me and tell me that I was making all this up.
Oh, that I was doing too many things and I needed to just rest and recuperate, and it could just be a virus, could take a couple more weeks to get over it.
He tested me for Epstein-Barr virus.
They did a mono test.
We rolled out Lyme disease. We rolled out thyroid disorders.
There's an old Victorian term called neurasthenia, something applied to fainting Victorian ladies.
He put me on antidepressants.
They were very big on depression.
You know, do you just, you know, need some antidepressants maybe?
Maybe there's something going on in my head that's complicating this.
I really felt like I had brought this on myself.
When I was diagnosed, for sure, it was definitely a relief.
At first, I felt very vindicated, although I thought the name was ludicrous.
They don't understand that there's a whole cluster of things that are going on physically, that it's more than exhaustion.
Fatigue seems like such a weak word. Oh yeah, I've been fatigued too. Yeah, I'm chronically fatigued. But the syndrome is something completely different.
I didn't know what to do about my job. Could I keep my job? Could I get a leave of absence? Could I work part-time?
I had just gotten this employment, and I was very excited about it. And I also knew that if I didn't keep up my, you know, appearances at work, I was going to lose this job.
I would go into a classroom, and at the lunch break, when everybody went off to lunch, I would have to lie down on the floor to rest. So I finally said, you know, I can't continue this anymore.
Eventually, I went out and applied for disability.
I finally did get Social Security, and that has been a tremendous blessing. I would be on the streets if it weren't for that.
One time I became aware that there was a very high suicide rate among people with this condition. Because really, what are you going to do? You can't work. Your finances are in a mess. Your partner is probably fed up and ready to leave you. You can't pay your bills, and you feel horrible every day.
I keep talking about this sadness. It was a tremendous sadness.
Terrible, terrible grief. Horrible grief. I mean, I had wanted to have children, and I realized I would never have children, and that, you know, my odds of recovery were almost nil at that point. And then I went through a very difficult period of adjusting to the idea that maybe this was it. This is how I would live the rest of my life.
And I tried lots and lots of things. I tried acupuncture.
Chinese herbs.
Natural remedies and supplements.
Nothing like sugar, no alcohol.
Homeopathy, chiropractic.
Acupressure, supplements.
Fish oil and those omegas.
You know, trying to eliminate wheat, eliminating dairy.
Definitely there's some triggers. Some main triggers, usually a virus like mono or Epstein-Barr virus. Or some kind of trauma.
I think we have something specific to offer the world, which is, we're the canaries in the mine.
You know, they used to send a canary down into the coal mines before they would send the miners down. And if the canary died, then there was a gas leak. And if the canary was all right, then the coal miners could go down and do their mining.
We're saying, you know, everybody else is thinking, oh, you know, spray this place with Raid, get rid of the ants. But we are the people who are going to know better, and we're the people who are going to keep bringing it to people's attention until we get the message told. And when we do, we're going to make it better, not just for ourselves, but for everybody else at the same time. So maybe we have a mission. We're going to be the canaries and say, quick, get the oxygen. Don't stay down in this mine. That's my feeling on my very good days, is that's our job. We have a kind of a job to do, and we've all got to stay alive and keep doing it.
New cancer studies are recognizing common elements in diverse cancers, and researchers are looking into whether treatment needs to focus on those common elements instead of simply where the cancer manifests. The hope is that someday cancer will be a survivable chronic illness, like diabetes or AIDS. But the experience of cancer is very different depending which country you live in. There are some things about breast cancer that are universal. There's the initial fear and the sense that your body is turned against you. After that, experiences diverge. Reporter Joanne Silberner of Seattle, Washington, had one experience. A woman in Uganda, where there are few treatment options and the disease carries a stigma, had a very different one.
My name is Joanne Silberner. I'm a freelance reporter, and I teach journalism at the University of Washington. Last year, I traveled to Uganda, Haiti, and India to do radio stories about cancer in developing countries. I met a woman in Uganda who, like me, has had breast cancer. I spent an afternoon hearing about her experiences, and I came home and I started thinking about mine. In some ways, her story is a lot like mine, and in other ways, our stories are very different. On August 9th, 2010, I was diagnosed with breast cancer.
My name is Gertrude Nachigude. I'm an accountant. I'm a founding member for Uganda Women's Cancer Support Organization. And this is an organization formed by breast cancer survivors. My finding out, I just attached my breast accidentally and felt a swelling, and which swelling I didn't take serious. I touched it, felt it, and I didn't mind. I was sharing a house with a friend, and I told her. Then she said, why you bother about something that's not painful? So I also kept quiet. I had a lamp fire. I didn't go to hospital. I had it. I always felt it.
I got my breast cancer diagnosis after a routine mammogram. It came 3 days before I was scheduled to move 2,700 miles from Atlanta to Seattle. I knew I'd get breast cancer. My mom died of it. My dad was exposed to radiation during medical training, and he got it too. But I had trouble believing the initial diagnosis. I figured the Atlanta doctors had gotten a little too excited about some equivocal tests.
It was after like 8 months. It had started growing big. Every time I touched, it was bigger than before. But at one time, I felt a sharp pain. And that's when I decided to take to a surgeon to remove it. To me, it was remove it. And when they removed it, that's when they told me I had breast cancer. When I heard that it was cancer, the feeling was terrible. I knew it was death. Here, people believe cancer is an untreatable disease.
In Seattle, doctors confirmed my diagnosis. Definitely cancer, and it definitely had to go. If you're going to have breast cancer, you may as well be me. As a journalist, I understand the issues pretty well. I've been writing about advances and controversies in breast cancer treatment for 30 years. My husband is a physician, and he understands things even better. I had enormous support from him and from the rest of my family. I knew what to do, and I could afford it. I was and remain fully insured.
For me, getting treatment was also another nightmare because there was no free treatment at that time. Nobody knew what to do. My family didn't know what to do. Nobody. We didn't even know where cancer is treated. We went to clinic. Of course, you pay money. And when we had spent all the money, I had to go to Mulago because I know it's a government hospital and it's free.
Early on a Tuesday morning, I had a mastectomy. It was a rare sunny day in Seattle, and I got immediate reconstruction. That night, the hospital served fresh salmon for dinner. This is Seattle, after all. My husband slept in a chair beside me. The next day, we went home.
I got mastectomy. I had surgery for the total removal of the breast. And then when I recovered 1 month, I started on chemotherapy. I was supposed to go for radiotherapy, but the machine was down for many months. So I missed that, but I proceeded for hormonal therapy. After chemotherapy, I would go home and people didn't know what to do if you needed to vomit. I mean, when I felt nausea, when I felt bad, people didn't know what to do. And we always kept running back to hospital.
What has having had breast cancer meant to your life?
To me, at that time, I felt it was the end of my life. You know, I had finished my university, I had got a job, I was preparing to get married and develop my career, and then cancer came in. So it was like a cutoff. I couldn't continue with my career, and I was worried maybe my boyfriend would leave me. I felt I was a curse.
A curse?
Mm-hmm.
In the U.S., cancer survivors are celebrated. Patients and friends and families march in giant parades that extend for miles. Bright pink shirts and bracelets and caps and ribbons are badges of honor.
People feel if you have a member of the family who have had cancer, probably your daughters or sons will not marry because people will be scared about that family. I felt I was alone. Suddenly, I learned later that I'm not alone.
Despite being emotionally and financially supported, I was angry. I didn't feel like I deserved cancer. Not that anyone does. It meant time away from work. There was pain during the post-op period. I had just moved away from most of my friends and family. The disease had taken my mother. Wasn't that enough? I couldn't help it. I was really angry.
Were you ever angry?
Well, I was very angry about with myself, with God, with my body betraying me. I was very faithful with my life, and I said, why, when I come from an area which was most hit by HIV? And I said, now I was so careful with my own life to survive HIV, and how come that God gives me cancer this time? I was very angry, but I have outlived the anger.
I don't think breast cancer will kill me, at least not most of the time. But sometimes I wake up in the middle of the night, or I read about someone my age dying of breast cancer. And I think about whether or not I'm ready.
Do you ever think you're going to die of breast cancer?
No, as per now, I don't think of dying breast cancer. That's what I feel. I know, since I've lived for 10 years, I now die of natural death. First, I thought our experience in Africa would be different from somebody's experience in America, but the fear is the same, the fear of death. I mean, to ask why me? So, I mean, to feel sorry about yourself, and so your experience is good and also touches me, and I feel we have the same destiny.
That's our show for this week. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our theme music is by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. If you'd like to hear this show again or visit the 51% archives, go to our website at wamc.org. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll be back next week with another edition of 51%, The Women's Perspective.